Welcome to the Sports Science Dudes. I'm your host, Dr. Jose Antonio, with my co-host, Dr. Tony Ricci. If you're a first-time listener, hit the subscribe button and like this show. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Our special guest today is Dr. Jonathan Mike. He currently teaches in the Exercise Science and Sports Performance Program at Grand Canyon University in Phoenix, Arizona. Grand Canyon, beautiful place. He has worked as a strength and conditioning coach and has contributed to dozens of online fitness, strength, and consumer outlets in the country. He has been involved in the past with the NSCA and previously served on numerous committees and special interest groups and has spoken at over 70 events, including many for the NSCA and ISSN, NASM, and numerous other fitness organizations. Jonathan has authored numerous peer-reviewed and scientific publications and has written 12 book chapters related to sports nutrition and strength and conditioning. Jonathan is a sought-after presenter nationally and internationally. So it is great to have you on the show. Dr. Mike, how are you?
Awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm super pumped. I'm stoked.
Hey, we're going to have fun with this.
We're going to have so much fun with this. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, because we're going to beat the crap out of you. Just so you know that, Dr. Mike. No, we're just big fuzzy teddy bears. Hey, I do want to make one quick promotional announcement. Tony and I, we are co-authors. A paper that literally was just published this morning in the journal Physiologia. What the hell kind of name is that? Weight loss and competition, weight comparing male and female mixed martial arts artists competing in the Ultimate Fighting Championships flyweight division. Really, I want to give, you know, we should give big thanks to Charles Stahl, Duncan French, working at the UFC Performance Institute. Without them, we, you know, this wouldn't be possible. And Corey Peacock was lead author, so he put a lot of work into putting the manuscript together. So that's, I think, our third publication working with UFC.
Yeah, it's exciting. We're, you know, our Nova Fight Science Lab here, and we're collaborating with them, and we're very appreciative. They're sharing great information and data that, other than some of it being in the cross-sectional analysis, most of it's brand new. And that's really helping us to get a little bit of a grip, a little bit of an idea on the weight cutting process, what's happening currently, and some of the strategies that may be most effective in the future too. So really excited. And as you said, Joey, a thanks to Dr. Duncan French and Charles Stahl, the new performance nutrition director at the USCPI.
That's true. He got promoted. That's
he got promoted.
Very cool. All right, Dr. Mike, you are quite prolific on social media, trying to educate the masses. Sometimes I worry about the masses because they will believe all sorts of bullshit that's posted online. And it seems that, and it's ironic that it seems that when people have literally more followers, the average person will presume or assume that person knows what they're talking about. It's like, well, you know, the food babe has whatever, 1 million followers, so she must know what she's talking about, you know, whereas, you know, Tony and I, we have like 3 followers and they're like our next door neighbor, you know, so who's going to believe us? But I like your content because it's educational. And what I want to do today is talk about some of them and maybe present an alternative point of view to see how the audience gauges it. And one of the ones I wanted to bring up, which is something I heard as a kid, Tony's heard as a kid. You're still a young man, Jonathan. So, you know, Tony and I are in the fourth quarter of our life. I don't even think you've reached halftime yet. So
I'm in the fourth floor.
How many floors are left?
I'm in the approaching the 42nd floor.
All right. That's, you're in a high rise, my man. You got a lot of time left.
You got a lot of time. Now,
you
had one post, which was the worst fitness quotes ever created.
I enjoyed that one, actually.
And one of them is actually quite popular, no pain, no gain. And I want to do this. We're going to play a game. What if I substituted the word discomfort for pain and said no discomfort, no gain? Would that now be true?
In a lot of ways, yeah, because I don't really know anyone who trains hard, whether they currently compete or a past competitor at a high level, who's done really well, who has not experienced any type of discomfort, mm-hmm. whether it's with, you know, doing things nutritional wise or, you know, putting your body through different, you know, discomfort regimens that is needed to enhance both physiological adaptation or on the mental side or physiological side. I can't really think of anybody who trains hard, who has a high level of, you know, results, whether they're coaches or trainers or, you know, competitors, that has not put themselves through a long series of discomfort, either in a given training session or over a course of, say, a year or over a course of, you know, several decades, you know, worth of training. Now, I guess you can say the flip side. I mean, can you get good results without being in discomfort all the time? Sure, you can, but it's not to the same degree. It's not to the same magnitude. I mean, again, I don't know anybody. I mean, when I was competing in sport of strongman, and I do say that because it is true. I have competed in the past. I've done 8 contests. I got top 4 for all of them, qualified for national contests. There's nothing really comfortable about doing car deadlifts, right, or lifting Atlas stones or some other type of, you know, event, you know, whatever it is. I mean, there's nothing like very comfortable about it. So I don't really know anybody who really gets to high levels, whether it's in competition or especially business or entrepreneurship, that just wants to think they're going to achieve what they want and just being comfortable all the time.
So then if you sort of carry further, then isn't no pain, no gain true? Because we're just substituting words. If you take, like, you competed in strongman, I always say and I don't know if Tony would agree, but to me, the most painful sport, before I answer that, I remember going to a cross country meet because my kids used to run in high school. And someone had pointed out that someone was wearing a shirt that said, "Our sport is your sport's punishment." Meaning when baseball players F up,
good shirt,
make them run. When if you're volleyball, your volleyball practice, you mess up, make them run. Basketball practice, hey, guess what? You get to do suicides because you guys are messing around. Is for distance running, which is probably, I think it's the most painful of sports. I don't think it's possible to get better without pain. So when I see no pain, no gain, in my mind, I'm like, well, of course that's true. I actually have no issue with even the word pain. Because some sports, there's a lot of mixed martial arts, there's a lot of pain. You can't avoid the pain.
Go ahead.
I guess the question, Jonathan, is why do people push back on this so much when in fact it's actually true?
Yeah, it is true, actually. And I think the phrase itself, in terms of the context, is from probably the 70s or 80s. And like looking back, it was like you won't be able to really achieve a high level of anything without going through some type of like pain. Well, yeah, so there is a lot of truth to it. But somebody could also say, oh, no pain, but you have to be in like physical pain or some type of like injury or previous injury in order to like, but that's a different context, right? I mean, I don't have ever trained through pain. Yeah, I have. And I've been injured at the same time while I'm competing, which again, it's just part of the sport. It's part of what you're really trying to achieve. You know, when people use the terms like injury prevention, I don't really care for that term anymore because you can't really 100% prevent injuries. You're like, you really need to be more like an injury reduction.
Right.
So yeah, the same statement is true, like no pain, no gain, but it's interesting that if you just, like you said, Joey, like if you switched out a couple of words, now it takes on a whole different context.
And I just want to add too, I think you were also talking, Dr. J, in the context of health. Now, there's a big difference between health and elite performance, right? Like you don't really have to be, you can do a lot of brisk walking. You can do some band training, moderate resistance training, and not be in significant pain and be healthy.
That's very true. And I think people, it's a lot of it is context, and the vast majority of people nowadays lack context. They lack the ability to put things into context, and they lack perspective. The idea is that health, you know, people say, I just want to be healthy. Well, that's cool. And there's nothing wrong with that. But your idea of healthy and my idea of healthy are pretty much polar opposites.
Yeah.
But in terms of a general, like people just want to be healthy. Well, it's just, there's absence of disease or disability. That's really what it is, right? if you want to get down to it, I mean, there's competing at high levels, whether it's bodybuilding, strongman, you know, MMA stuff. It's really not the healthiest thing if you really think about it, you know? So if you just want to be healthy and have good blood markers and without disease and disability, that's cool. Yeah. But if you want to go to higher levels, like it just, there's certain things that you're going to have to accept and it comes with the job.
Right.
Yeah. It's and it's interesting. You mentioned that, like the idea of, you don't like the term injury prevention, right? And you know, people criticize CrossFit because it is so injurious that people, you know, the method of training produces injuries. And when you think about it, pretty much every competitive sport, I would say eventually everyone gets injured. Mm-hmm. There's a 100% injury rate, whether it's tennis, running, lifting, everybody gets injured. Maybe the rates are different, but it's, you're guaranteed. If you have a goal that's difficult to reach, you're going to get hurt. It's just the way it is. I mean, yeah. I don't know how many times I've had shoulder issues from paddling. And I adjust the stroke, but then here's what's funny. I adjust it, but now my low back hurts. I'm like, shit. Okay. Now I have to adjust this so the low back doesn't hurt. Then it just shifts it to my shoulder. And I'm like, all I'm doing is shifting the pain. That's all I'm doing. with fighting, obviously it's a different kind of pain.
Oh yeah. But I think people just, like, they lack perspective. And one of the things, I mean, social media has been great in terms of, you know, content and education and, you know, business and stuff. But it has glorified other things that typically really can't be possible. And what I mean is, you know, in terms of the business and entrepreneurship, like it's just been glorified, like, oh, you know, buy my course, you know, for 6 weeks and like you're going to make, you know, seven figures. It's like all this other shit. Well, it's just been glorified for people to see that they can't really put in, you know, a lot of the actual work. But, you know, and it's funny because I've always said people would make so much better progress if they actually had something they were training for, right? You know exactly what you need to do. There's different types of training methods, but you have an end goal in mind. Yep. And those that can be separated into short-term, you know, mid-term goals. One of the reasons from like a large perspective is people have long-term goals with a short-term mind, right? People need long-term goals with a long-term mind, right? Yep. And so, you know, it's if you look at some of the highest level athletes in the world, when a lot of them retire, they actually make really good entrepreneurs and business people, is because they've set the stage and tone for years of just being disciplined and being structured. And they're able to achieve a different level of success outside, you know, the realm of sport. So, you know, that's, if you want to be healthy, that's great. But if you want to be more disciplined and get to a higher level, you're going to have to do things that most people are not willing to do, so you can do things other people can't do.
Yeah, it's true. People tend to have a very parochial view of this. And, you know, when I'm asked, you know, I'll have relatives, cousins ask about training for whatever or reaching a particular goal. And they'll always put what I call a short time frame around it. It's like, well, I want to get this done. You know, I want to reach this in 6 to 12 months. And I tell them all the time, you have to eliminate the idea, you know, particularly let's say it's weight loss, because almost everyone wants to lose weight. You have to eliminate the idea that somehow magically you're going to lose the weight you want to lose in 6 to 12 months and keep it off. Because obviously there are lifestyle factors that you've engaged in that has contributed to your weight gain. It's not just going to magically disappear. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the problem with social media, and we're all aware of this, is that people see things, you know, I call it this minutia. There's this minutia that's just being churned in social media. Like, hey, you need to get into a cold tub. Hey, you need to get in a sauna. Hey, you need to wake up and stare at the sun. Hey, it's all of this, just, it's bullshit that it's like going to a doctor and you're complaining to the doctor about a pimple on your ass when in fact you got pancreatic cancer. You know what? Deal with pancreatic cancer, not the pimple on your ass. So how do you deal with, you know, the analogy is deal with the big stuff, i.e. train correctly. You got to have a goal. Eat better, right? Don't eat all that shit. Get plenty of sleep. Take supplements that might help you, depending on your goal. And those basic things work, but no one likes basic stuff.
And you know why? Because most of the basic stuff, it's not sexy to people, yeah. Right? You know, that it just comes down to it's all this meat and potatoes with purposely no fork with which to eat, because they're trying to always sell you on things to basically and intentionally get you away from doing the fucking work. No.
Right. And you know, to your point too, basic isn't sexy. And if you keep things basic, you lose your audience regarding social media.
Yes.
So, yeah. Right. You can't. I mean, how many times can you tell somebody, well, here's some good food, here's how you hydrate, sleep well, and here's some pretty good tips for training. You're done. Yeah, if you keep it basic like that, you have to get to the fringe and periphery or entice people with things that may be, like we said, less common in your daily practice.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest downsides to social and the context that we're talking about is, you know, individuals that purposely try to make things very complicated and overcomplicated to get people to think, oh, I had to do the complicated stuff in order to actually get results. And that's not the case at all. In fact, to the contrary, it's quite the opposite. I mean, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. I mean, there's a reason why tried and true training principles like still exist and they still work. There's a reason why higher protein diets are still around because they still work. You know, there's a reason why fundamental movement patterns are still around, because they still work. So, you know, you don't have to stand on Bosu balls on a single leg with chains wrapped around your neck, you know, chewing bubble gum, you know, hanging by a band on your neck and all this other silly stuff. You know, it's just the fundamentals day in and day out and just being consistent with it. And
yeah,
you're right. It's like people just don't want to hear that because they've been inundated thinking that they have to do all this complicated stuff. Yeah. And it ultimately gets them more excuses, to not ultimately do the work. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think of at least in the last 5 or 10 years, this, and again, I call it nickel and dime science, where they're comparing sets and reps. You know, let's compare 3 sets of 10, 10 sets of 3, or 5 sets of 6 versus, you know, 10 sets of triples or something. And it's this kind of minutia where, well, one, no one ever trains the exact same way all the time. If they do, they don't know how to train. And two, what people do today, let's say, because you're an avid lifter, I don't even lift anymore. I just paddle. Tony doesn't like to lift too much because he'll grow too much. He doesn't want a hypertrophy. He's got a weird problem that, you know, most people don't have. So he's like, I don't need any more hypertrophy, so I'll limit the lifting. But this idea that, you know, the way you train today isn't the same way you train 6 months from now. You're always altering things. So when I see these studies, sets and reps, here, what goes in my mind, and I want your opinion on this, Tony and Jonathan, is, what a fucking waste of time. If you know the principles of training, all of this stuff doesn't matter. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I still get inundated with these questions, and not as much as I used to, but you still, people ask questions like, what are the best sets and reps for X? What are the best sets and reps for like strength or hypertrophy? And, you know, and part of the current problem still is, you know, what a lot of the textbooks, you know, really say, and it's not a knock on, you know, the basic, you know, information in and of itself, but you have to be in a position to adapt and evolve and innovate and critically and analytically think. And a lot of that comes through experiences and exposures. I've talked about that for like 10 years. I mean, people can have a lot of experience, but their exposures are very, very limited. So you may have experience, you know, with, you know, bodybuilding or competing, you know, 6 times, 12 times, whatever it is. But if your exposures to a wide variety of other types of training programs or method is limited, then all you're going to be able to do with coaches and clients is what you know, you know, is bodybuilding. Now, that's not a negative on, you know, there's great bodybuilding coaches and stuff. There's awesome competitors out there, but that's for a specific sport, for a specific type of training goal. You know, when people say, oh, every, you know, and it's like, we've gone through this, you know, decade plus of everything has to be like 3 sets of 10 and 4 sets of 10, mm-hmm. You know, well, what about things like 5 sets of 5, yeah. You know, or like 8 sets of 3, or if you're doing the conjugate training system, or, you know, max effort method or dynamic effort method, or, you know, repetition method, you know, 4 sets of 6. What about things like, you know, way back when, you know, Charles Poliquin was talking about a 7-5-3, you know, or like 6-4-2, you know, type of method. It really doesn't matter the reps that you really do. What really matters is how much mechanical tension do you have on the muscle? That's what ultimately really matters, because that's really the main driver of hypertrophy. I'm sorry to inform everybody, but it's not volume. Like people think it really is. You can do a bunch of volume and not make, you know, good muscular, you know, progress and muscular development progress, because it ultimately depends on the mechanical tension that you have on the muscle. You know, we can get into, you know, training to failure, close to failure, and that's cool. But you can do a bunch of junk volume, you know, six sets of chest and six, you know, or six exercises of chest and six for hamstrings, but it doesn't always equate to you growing, you know, large amounts of lean body mass, you know, over time. Like, will you get stronger? Of course. Will you get some hypertrophy? Yeah. But you're not going to be able to continually sustain and increase maximize hypertrophy by just doing a bunch of junk reps and junk volume without increased mechanical load, you know, on the muscle. Which, how do you do that? Is by something that, I don't know who needs to hear this, it's called progressive overload, right? So that's ultimately what it comes down to. And I think, you know, we get in this situation where with like the sets and reps, well, hypertrophy is, you know, 4 to 6 sets in the, you know, 8 to 12 rep range. Yeah, that still works. And that's typically the sweet spot. But again, it depends on your exercise, what the load is, you know, rest periods, what your progressive, there's a lot of factors that really go into that. But I've always made the joke of, you know, what a lot of traditional textbooks talk about, you know, strength and hypertrophy and endurance, like, okay, 12 to 15 reps or plus 15 reps is like muscular endurance. And I'm like, well, you know, your body doesn't just shut off after you get past 12 reps, and now you're rep 15, and like your body's like, oh, well, I'm in muscular endurance now. You're never going to get any more strength or hypertrophy. Like, I shouldn't. Right. This is stupid shit, right? Your body doesn't understand that. Your body doesn't even know what hypertrophy is to begin with. It just knows like rate coding and motor unit recruitment, you know, synchronization and mechanical load and tension on the muscle. Like, and that's a neuromuscular and brain thing. You know, so that's what I would really say to that. People need to stop having paralysis by analysis. Like, they just start thinking about this and this and this. And it ultimately comes down, are you executing on these workouts? Are you executing on the lifts? You know, the basics work, and there's no doubt about that. Do advanced training methods work? Of course they do. You know, bands and chains and doing different types of ranges of motion and different planes of motion, you know, partials, eccentrics, isometrics, they're all great training tools and they all work. But it's, you know, do you need to do those? You don't need to all the time. But you know, if you're training like a novice individual, you need to be focused on like just, you know, 6 or 7 basic fundamental movements: push, press, you know, hinge, you know, squat, some type of lunge, some type of carry pattern, and not worry about how many chains or bands that you have on the bar and what specialty bar that you're using.
Yeah. Tony, what are some things that, particularly with fighters, whether it's boxers, wrestlers, MMA guys, some of the things Jonathan mentioned, what are some things that you utilize and others that might be a surprise to the audience that you might typically avoid?
Well, I think that we don't fight too much in terms of trying to strengthen a fighter or, you know, increase power on repetition range. And we don't get into those nuances too much because we really don't have that liberty. We really need the smallest possible dose with the best possible result, right? Because they're training, unless they don't have a fight for 6-7 months, then maybe we can consider that. But I think if your objective is to build strength, I agree with Dr. J here, the mechanical tension, very important. We'll use a few compound movements in the early phases, try to help intramuscular coordination. What if the athlete is an athlete, though, that maybe has the capacity to induce a lot of hypertrophy naturally when they do lift? Sometimes we de-emphasize the eccentric loading in the hope that potentially we might decrease the, you know, the hypertrophy response. That could be one factor. So I would say this, though, we use a lot of the principles. We don't get into repetition ranges of 8 to 10, 12 most of the time, unless that's in warm-up fashion. If we want general strength and general power, we're in the 5 or 6 to repetition range. The load changes according to objective. If it's strength, power, right, or a little bit speed, strength, And that's about where we keep it, because that's a sweep rep range that we're probably going to get most of the benefits that we need. Am I going to, you should have done eight, or I should have went to triples. We don't have that kind of luxury. Again, the stimulus has to be limited. It has to be relatively low volume and relatively compound in nature, you know, in the strength phase, if you will, or power. And then you could go into more of the nuanced stuff and in working multilateral and a change of direction later. But again, to reiterate, hypertrophy is not even on our radar. We could care less about hypertrophy. If it's a mild side effect of the lifting that we do, we'll allow it to occur, you know, but we don't 8 to 10, 12 reps. That's not even in our vocabulary. Here's the general repetition range. It's more like Dr. J said, we're interested in the tension. And the only thing that really changes, the repetition ranges are generally in that potentially 5, maybe 6, 8 max. And the load changes and the velocity at which we're training changes according to the load. That's really all that goes on from the pure resistance training. That's completely different from agility training, response, change of direction. That's separate. But it basically comes down to what he just said, right? We want to get the body stronger and more resilient. 6 reps, some of the compounds, build the frame again, strengthen the connective tissue, get the muscle strong again, and then take it from there.
Yeah, I think it's also sport dependent too. I mean, you look at a sport like golf. I mean, you know, nobody cares about how much you deadlift.com, you know, if you're a professional golfer. I mean, you have skill acquisition. You know, there's a lot of depth perception that goes on, which is part of the skill of the actual sport. You need rotational power, you need thoracic and hip, you know, mobility and rotational power. You know, and you just need some, you know, overall higher than level baseline, like aerobic endurance. And I would even throw in some anaerobic, you know, stuff in there too, just to train those energy systems. So it's ultimately like sport dependent, and that drastically and vastly changes with who you're actually really working with. You know, you kind of added on to what you said a few minutes ago, you know, for MMA guys, I mean, you're not going to probably do much more than like, you know, 6 reps and, you know, 12, 15 reps, what type of stuff, you know, and like, if I'm working like with a new client, I won't do 12 reps or 15 reps. I'll stick to the 6 rep range, maybe 8 at the most, is particularly if they're a novice trainee, because, you know, if you think about it, you're at that time, you're going to gain neuromuscular adaptations regardless of what you do. And so you want to try and utilize and have efficient in terms of motor unit recruitment and just neuromuscular control without the onset and presence of fatigue. And you know, when I talk about junk volume, you do get a fair amount, and people forget this. If you're just doing a bunch of volume with stuff, you will create a lot of central and peripheral fatigue, unnecessarily, right? Mm-hmm. And like in terms of the presence of fatigue, you know, and I know there's a pronounced, you know, researcher, I believe he's still out of, you know, Australia, has been around for a long, long time, talked about, you know, the fatigue hypothesis and all that stuff. And I'm at the perspective now that central and peripheral fatigue or may not be like an actual like thing, because fatigue comes from either the brain, the spine, or the neuromuscular system, right? So, you know, you don't think you can get like central fatigue or central nervous system or sympathetic fatigue, but you have to look at where that actually comes from first, which is either brain, spine, or neuromuscular, you know, junctions, you know, and that's ultimately what it comes down to. So yeah, that's kind of in the confines of fatigue and, you know, hypertrophy and stuff, but yeah, people are just overcomplicating the process. But people need to understand, like, can you build some muscle and get stronger in like 6-8 weeks? You know, of course you can. Mm-hmm. But it takes a long, long time to build a profound physique, regardless of what, you know, especially if you're in physique sports. You know, a tennis player, like, they're going to be lean, you know, they're going to have rotational power. They have to compete. Like, they're not in the physique sport, you know, business. They're not in the fight business. Right. You know, so it depends on what, again, goes back. What are you training for?
Yep. Yeah. And that goes back to, you know, instead of focusing on this minutia, if you know the basic principles of training, you can adapt it to the person based on their goals. So I want to switch subjects a little bit to, and I think people will find this one interesting. It was quite popular. Biggest mistakes women make in their training. So this is Jonathan Mike mansplaining. I just want everyone to know that. No, I'm kidding. But there was a lot here that's true. There's, in fact, I would almost say there's a lot here that's true with a lot of people, not just women. So I'm just going to go through them, and then you and Tony can, you know, can expound on these. Number one, not eating enough protein. Well, we know that's a problem for a lot of people. Number two, and this one's interesting, performing endless hours of cardio, and we're going to have you operationally define what too much is. Number three, not lifting heavy enough stuff. Again, going back to, hey, tension overload, skeletal muscle response to contractile tension, contractile overload. This one, and maybe this is one that's kind of a social media creation, doing 95% booty work, 5% upper body. It seems like every damn post is like, how many hip thrusts are you going to post? How many? Can you post something?
I like that one. That's spot on.
Can you do dumbbell flies or military press? Something. But, you know, hip thrusts. Come on. And then this one, and I know guys don't do this. Sorry, that's mansplaining, but always stressing out over the scale. In fact, when I step on the scale and I'm a little chubby, I'm like, hey, I gained some weight. Holy shit. I come back from a cruise. I've gained 5 pounds of fat. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. It'll come off eventually. I'm not worried. So I'll repeat those again. Always stressing out over the scale. Not lifting heavy enough. 95% butt work. Not enough upper body. Not eating enough protein and performing endless hours of cardio. So when you were putting this together, Jonathan, was this stuff that it was always in your head because you see it so much? Or did you contact all your female friends and say, hey, what do you guys think?
It's actually a little bit of both, but probably more on the former, you know, than the latter. I mean, it is true. Like the protein one, obviously for females is very true, but the same thing can be said about people in general or even men. Like it's not, you know, discriminant of, you know, it really anybody. The truth is that the vast majority of people just don't eat enough protein, especially older adults. In fact, older adults actually need more protein over the course of a day or a giving serving. Cause as you get older in terms of age. Now, I'm not talking about like age 20 to 25. I'm talking age 25 to versus like 55 or like 65. You know, they need more protein because as you get older, your body becomes more resistant like to the anabolic effects of amino acids. So you need more protein to maintain a given amount of lean body mass. So that's on the protein stuff. You know, on the scale, yeah, that's definitely more of a female thing, but you know, men do have, you know, muscle dysmorphia. Like it's a real thing. You know, you can be like 280 pounds and, you know, shredded to the gills and look in the mirror and feel small. It's a real thing. And it's just not talked about. It's kind of like taboo, you know, like for men, but, you know, because of, you know, advances in science and, you know, nutritional supplement research and, you know, body recomposition, you know, somebody could be training for 8 weeks, 10, 12 weeks or whatever it is, or even a course over like a year and their total body weight is not changing much, right? But their percent body fat goes down. They've added a lean body mass and they've dropped some inches on their waist. I mean, there's a lot to be said about that. And that is a real thing. You know, body recomp is a real thing. You know, like I stay anywhere from maybe like 270 to upwards of like, you know, 285, like throughout the year. And probably 275 ish, you know, especially because traveling and all that stuff. But you know, there was a time when like I was pretty heavy. I was heavier. I think I got up to 308, you know, at one time.
Damn, that's heavy.
Yeah, 300, 305. And this was actually not competing. And I was this was actually post PhD, because everybody knows, you know, when you do a PhD, like you're probably not going to look the best. So just because of added stress, but yeah, I got up to like 300, 305 and like, I was super strong. But you know, all I really did was just, you know, eat more salads, you know, lower some of the processed stuff a little bit, lower the carbs a little bit, you know, change the training a little bit, but just got in more steps. And, you know, now I kind of maintain the same body weight, but I've noticed over time, like my body composition, you know, has dropped, you know, so that is a real thing. But yeah, stressing over the scale, I mean, the scale does nothing but tell you what number, you know, gravity is weighing down on you, you know, type of thing. It's not going to tell you anything about bone mineral density, you know, your blood work markers, how much total lean body mass you have or segmental lean body mass. You know, percent body fat, you know, it just doesn't help you with a DEXA or skin folds. It's not going to do a scientific research study on you. So people get freaked out a lot. But, you know, the point is that are you getting stronger? Are your lifts going up? Are you feeling better in clothes? Do you, look and feel better, you know, naked? Are you more confident? You know, what's your and people talk about, okay, what's your nutritional habits like? And what is your lifestyle like? Right. You know, cause you could eat great Monday through Friday and, you know, you can binge all weekend and, you know, before you know it, like you're creeping up the calories here and there before you even really know it. You know, so yeah, body recomposition is definitely, it's certainly more of a positive, you know, than it ever is, you know, a negative. So we got the protein, we got body recomp. What was that one? Booty band booties.
Doing yeah. Booty? 95% booty work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know you guys had Brett Contreras on the podcast, you know, recently, but you know, if you look at somebody like him, I mean, his clients, they train upper body too. Like they do rows, they do pull-ups, you know, they do some, you know, dumbbell bench stuff, but it's all basic things. But, you know, it looks like all they do is actual, booty work.
Sorry to interrupt you. Were you surprised with the results from the study that they funded that was done in Mike Roberts' lab where they compared hip thrust to squats and that hypertrophy was the same? And in fact, if you look at individual data points, there were people who did the hip thrust that, for lack of a better term, they actually atrophied, at least in the upper glute. So it did resolve a question that in untrained people, overall squats are better because it gets your quads, it gets your legs, not just your butt. And in terms of actual gluteus maximus hypertrophy, there wasn't a difference. So what are your thoughts on that?
I wasn't really all that surprised, you know, to be honest. And, you know, people will certainly take that out of context and say, and see, like I told you, glutes, hip thrusts do X, but squats do, you know, X. Like the bottom line is like, just put your big boy panties on and just do both exercises.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, and that's what it comes down to. I mean, you know, when you look at, you know, squat patterns, and obviously no one person squats the same or even deadlifts the same or shit, quite frankly, even move the same. You know, when you get to heavier loading patterns, and yeah, when people squat big weights, I mean, yeah, they have strong and big quads, but super heavy weights, you know, your glutes and adductors are going to be taken over in terms of like hip extensors, because they can just produce a lot more force, you know, than your quads can, you know, or, you know, knees and quads. So at heavier loads, that typically happens. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't really all that surprised, but I'm somebody of the training philosophy that I do like both. If you're talking about squats and deadlifts in that study, right, like I do both and I do different variations, you know, of it. I'm a huge fan of the Nautilus hip thruster. We have one of the gyms that I go to. It's actually the only, or if one of very few, hip thrust devices that I can actually fit in.
Wait. Okay. I used to work at a Nautilus fitness center back in college. Is this the one where you're laying on your back and you're, I guess the back of your knee is pressing down. Is that what we're talking about? Or is it, because they had different glute machines, the Nautilus did.
The Nautilus hip thruster now is like you kind of get in it, your feet are a little bit slightly elevated on the platform. You have the handles kind of like right by your sides. And it's essentially like the hip thrust movement, and it's plate loaded. You load the plates on the side. But it's very easy access, and it's very easy to kind of get in and out of. And it's one of the only things that I can actually fit in, versus other things like the booty builder. I just can't fit in most of those machines, and they're not the most comfortable. But again, like, you know, different strokes for different folks, but I do, you know, different variations, you know, single leg movements, you know, rear foot split squats. But I mean, I don't understand why people just get so bogged down with, you know, told you this, told you that. Just do both exercises and do different variations so you can try to maximize the training response.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah, Tony, do you have a comment on it? Because yeah,
no, just I can't. It's we're not feeding hungry children and curing cancer. You know, the debates are fine and they're wonderful, but to Dr. J's point, there are really good, clear benefits from both movements. Why should they not be incorporated? Right. People are more interested than being right than accurate, right? And that's a big problem. Proving some, you know, this is wrong, this is right. I mean, so anyway, there are benefits to all movements at some given point. If you don't have the time and you have to make the choice, okay, of one over the other, you do that. But nevertheless, if you can integrate both of those movements into your program at some given point, do so.
Yeah. And there's oftentimes a point of like, you know, diminishing returns. And what I mean by that, I'm not talking about the effectiveness of either of those movements. What I'm talking about is, say, just take like squats and deadlifts. I mean, they're highly technical. They have a high skill set. And as the load goes up, it's higher demand.
Right.
Whereas you look at something like, you know, a Nautilus hip thrust machine, it's not nearly as technical. It's not very demanding, but you have a lot of stress on, you know, certain areas of, you know, glute max, you know. So different exercises, and movements have different skill sets and different demands.
Yes.
And so people need to start thinking like that, right? I mean, I'm not going to ever train somebody. And I've always said this too, like not everything's a barbell, not everything's a dumbbell, not everything's a kettlebell, and not everything is squat, bench, and power clean either.
Exactly.
In fact, you know, if you look across the board, you know, with the research in terms of power development, I mean, power development has a wide range of percentages, you know, based upon the movement that you're really trying to do. I mean, you can get somebody pretty powerful and not really do a whole lot of power cleans. You know, so again, both exercises are good, but every exercise you have to understand, like, what's the skill set? You know, what's the physiological demand? Is it high physical demand? I mean, you take different variations like a barbell squat versus the exact opposite, like a goblet squat. Well, one's high skill, one's high demand, you know, physical demand, and the other one's very simple and easy to do. Like, which one are you really going to choose for a novice or maybe even intermediate trainee? Because also keep in mind, and that's this, the higher level the skill set for the exercise means that you, the coach and trainer, have to take more time to coach and teach the person. Yeah. And that means more breakdown and more technical nuances of the lift. That's not a bad thing, and people need to understand that, but it could take away from other things that they may be wanting to do or achieve or something in a given training session. So you have to weigh all those pros and cons too.
Excellent point. Yeah, when dealing with athletic performance, just quickly, sometimes I don't have the time to take 6 weeks to teach a given lift to be perfect. So I go to the alternative. Yep.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned power development as it relates to, you know, training for it specifically. And when you look at, and Tony, when you look at the fight sports and Jonathan, there are just some guys and or girls, but you see some guys who can just knock you out with one punch. I mean, that's pure power right there. And yet you get other guys and you can train them and maybe in the weight room, more strength. You certainly got more power, but it doesn't translate to getting into a ring or a cage and having the one punch knockout. So it's like we can all make everyone more powerful. It doesn't mean you're going to have a one punch knockout. And so I want Tony to comment on that because, you know, just because it works in a weight room, it may not always translate into a real skill, you know, whether it's a one punch knockout, whether it's, you know, a tennis serve where you're constantly acing someone because the velocity of ball is so fast. So what do you think?
Well, there's so many factors, right? I mean, the biomechanics, the kinematics of what's going on individually in that genetically in that person, their timing, their depth perception, right? When they're hitting the person, what they're doing at the point of contact, you know, so power is, is it to limb length, segment length, the length of the muscle, tendon origin insertion? Is it neural? Is it up in the brain itself? And the answer is probably a bit of everything. And the way I compare it is to your point, and Dr. J would say it too. You can add more power to someone. There's no two ways around it. You can get them stronger. Maybe that will translate in due time to the skill set of punching harder. But it's like I tell my students, you have a type one fiber and all you ever do, you're born with more type ones, but all you ever do is lift weights. You're going to push some of the qualities of that type one a little bit more toward a type two. It's never going to be a type two, right? We don't think there's a full change. It's the same thing. There's natural qualities to knockout power that we don't even understand, but it's got to be in part timing, when to throw the punch, the range in the punch, the intramuscular coordination, the kinematics of it. They just snap. Is it the double pulse? They can explode, relax, and then tighten on contact. So it is the really cool thing to be, and I don't want to take any more Dr. J's time, is to do a damn study to find out what the hell's going on that creates this power.
Well, yeah, and I'm all for that. So you
know, let's collaborate on that.
Yeah,
one,
Dr. dude, J, you and I'm all for that. I mean, you look at, you know, you talk about fighting. I mean, you look at legends like Mike Tyson. I mean, did Mike Tyson really do a lot of like power stuff?
No.
I mean, No. Not really, you know, but he's just a genetic freak, right?
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, and then the track and field athletes like Usain Bolt. I mean, they're just genetic freaks.
Right. Mean,
that's what comes down to it. And I always laugh when people are analyzing like their workouts or their videos and say, you know, well, he's got, you know, this amount of degrees of like knee internal rotation at the sprint start. And dude, just get the hell out of here. You have no idea what you're talking about. You're really going to tell somebody who's like the fastest dude in the world and his best time is what, like 9.57, that he needs to do this. And
right.
Just stop, you know? So, I mean, yeah, but you're right, Tony. I mean, it's like you can enhance large degrees of power development, and power comes in many different shapes and forms and sizes. But it's, again, what are you training for, right? And you don't have to be a fighter or be in fight sports or be a rotational power athlete too. And this is the other thing too. You don't have to be in that specific sport or that type of athlete in order to benefit from power stuff and power development. In fact, a lot of older adults need to be generating higher levels of power output, I mean, along with strength and even like eccentric strength output. You know, because again, you know, the sarcopenia effect as you get older. So, you know, those are things that have been demonstrated very, very positively in the research in terms of preserving eccentric strength, you know, power development for older adults. So it's one of those things to where it actually benefits all demographics and all populations.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Yep.
Okay. One last topic, Jonathan, before we let you go. I'm going to reframe the question you posted. The question you posted was, does cardio kill your strength gains, bruh? Okay. But I'm going to put it within the context of sumo wrestling. Okay. Does cardio kill your sumo wrestling strength, bruh?
If you are a sumo wrestler, does cardio kill your strength gains?
You can even put power in there because it's a power sport. That's pure power.
Yeah. My response,
would you have sumo, because it's funny, I actually watch sumo on YouTube because I think it's fascinating and I watch how they train. Would you have sumo wrestlers doing cardio?
For the health benefits, yeah.
No, to win sumo.
To win, not really.
Yeah.
For the health benefits, yeah. And that's something that people just, if they just, they want to separate the health benefits from like the performance, you know, outcome, right? And they're not always mutually like exclusive. For the health benefits, yeah. But here's the other thing that people don't realize, and this is just basics of energy systems. And there's, I can't tell you how many people still don't understand like these energy system concepts. Like just take basic lifting, for example. You may be in the gym for like 2 hours, say hour and a half to 2 hours. But think about like, I mean, really make it make sense, people. How long are you actually doing like work? Like the total amount of time that you're really right. doing work. So you're in the gym for like an hour and a half to 2 hours. You're probably doing around maybe 40 minutes or 45 minutes of actual like work. If you add the total time up that you take all the contractions and all the sets, it'll be somewhere around that time frame, right? So my argument is, do you need a strong aerobic base for lifting? And I usually argue yes, because during your rest periods, you're actually utilizing mitochondrial respiration, which will help you facilitate recovery to and from sets and exercises and then the subsequent training sessions. I mean, this is just basic stuff. But the opposite can be true when you're actually doing the work, right? Well, you're utilizing phosphagen and glycolytic energy systems. So then you can actually train both energy systems. And I can tell you from experience that when I don't do a lot of, and I do high intensity steady state cardio and sled work and some battle rope stuff, when I go more than say 2 or 3 weeks without doing any of those, my training sucks. Mm. I can barely get through, you know, my recovery within workout recovery. Is not very well. It's not very efficient. And this is the reason why I think everybody needs to be training all energy systems throughout the year. But again, if you're a sumo wrestler, should you do it for health benefits? Yeah, but it's not really going to help you much to actually win, because you think about the time period to where you're actually wrestling the guy. I mean, the shit's over like less than 10 seconds, right?
Oh, you know, so, 10 seconds is long. It's over in like 2 or 3 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, for health benefits, sure. But, I mean, does a sumo wrestler need to be doing bow ropes and sled pushes to garner a higher level of performance for sumo wrestling? Probably not, unless they just want to throw it in just to have some fun, you know.
Right, right.
But, yeah, I mean, again, but if you're a highly trained endurance athlete, I think you should do, you know, high intensity anaerobic type of work at interval training, because most endurance athletes just don't run on flat terrain anymore.
Exactly.
You know, you look at triathletes, I mean, God, they're swimming, they're cycling, you know, swimming, cycling, you know, running. And it's also, you know, multiple terrain, and there's periods to where you have to kick it up in high gear, high intensity. And, you know, that's where I always kind of akin it to try to compare it to, like, you know, your car. I mean, you're wanting to go like 70 to 90 miles an hour. And you're driving like a 4-cylinder Prius, right? It's just not going to work. You know, so like you have to be able to kick things into high gear in terms of generating power output. But I mean, I can see an argument being made like on both sides, but yeah, I mean, a sumo wrestler, do they need like high amounts of anaerobic, you know, conditioning? Probably not, but can they benefit from, you know, steady state, you know, cardio for health benefits? Sure. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that actually, that touches on, you know, what's the goal, you know, in Japan, sumo is the number one sport. Those people are treated the way, you know, the Michael Jordans and the Tom Brady's of the world are treated. So there's sumo's king. Baseball is maybe a close second. So you don't want to be the sumo wrestler who's healthier. You right. want to be the one that wins.
So. That's true. And I don't really think a lot of sumo wrestlers, I know they eat a lot of calories, but I think people would be surprised. They don't eat like 5 or 6 meals a day.
They just eat a lot.
They eat a lot. You know, so they don't, I don't think they have to worry about how much protein they're eating.
No, not at all. In fact, I, you know, people say, God, they live a great life. They sleep, they eat, they train. So they're either wrestling or lifting weights. Then they just repeat it. They sleep, they eat, they train. It's like, well, that sounds like what a lot of college students do.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, like, you know, in Japan, I mean, Japan is consistently ranked as has one of the lowest obesity in accounts in the entire world, despite the fact that they eat rice, they eat fish, but they're just so much more active than people here in America. It's crazy.
Yeah, they still have the highest lifespan in the world, right? Them and I think Monaco or something.
Yeah, and that's even with, you know, the fact that sumo wrestlers tend to live, I think, 10 years less than the average Japanese male, but they still, you're right, in the
still 72 years old.
Yeah, they live longer than anyone. So, hey, Dr. Mike, it's been a great conversation. I want you to tell your audience where they can find you, where you're going to be, you know, things like that.
All right. We, most of you know, follow me on social, Dr. J. Mike. I'm obviously on Facebook, the same handle. I'm now on Threads, same handle, LinkedIn, same handle, Dr. J. Mike. And I will be launching YouTube towards the end of October. I speak anywhere from maybe 12 to 15, you know, conferences a year. I'm actually heading over to Singapore in a couple of weeks to do a full-day course on power development, rotational power. And then we head over to Bangkok, Thailand to speak at another big, you know, fitness event. So, yeah, that's where I'll be. You can find me on other social platforms. For those
Are that you on Twitter or X?
I am, but I don't really hardly ever do anything on that.
Okay.
I get on there once in a while, and whenever I get on there, I always see something pop up from Dr. Joey Antoni about some study about protein or ISSN related. So that's good.
He's good with that. Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, that's where I'll be. Appreciate the support and the follow. Awesome to come on. And, I love talking about this stuff.
Yeah, enjoyable and good information too. And there's a lot more for us to cover, I think. So we'll have to do a follow-up when you get back from circling the globe 3 or 4 times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
And have fun fitting in those coach class seats.
Oh, no. You got it wrong, bro. Like, I got premium economy. So they're wider seats. I got extra leg room. And then they feed you,
four or five times.
Oh, yeah. They feed you for sure. But because, like, on Singapore Airlines, you do what's called, and this is only for like premium or business class, they do what's called book the cook. So you can actually order, you know, kind of what you want to have served to you, like based off, you know, the selection. So yeah. So looking forward to it. But yeah, it was an awesome time to be on, and look forward to more.
Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate your time. Tony, catch you.
Dr. J, thanks, my man. Good luck on the travels.